I suspect many of us believe the Arab Spring put the Arab world firmly on the path to democracy and a better future. But according to our next guest, the truth is pretty much the opposite of that. John Bradley is an experienced foreign correspondent, a fluent speaker of Arabic, and author of several acclaimed books on the region, including his latest, After the Arab Spring. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Let's start by talking about Tunisia, where the Arab Spring began with the overthrowing of dictator Ben Ali and the Jasmine Revolution. How long have you been familiar with Tunisia?
Oh, 2 decades or more. I first went there during a university holiday way back in, I think, 1991, and fell in love with the country and have spent more time in that country, in fact, apart from Tunisia, than any other in the Arab world over the past 2 years.
Yeah, the regime there was often described in the Western media over the years as a dictatorship, but what was it actually like to live there?
There were clear red lines, which is to say that if you stayed away from certain political or religious topics, then you were pretty much free to do whatever you wanted. And it was very politically repressive, to be sure, but it was also very socially liberal. So, for example, extraordinarily, there in the heart of the Arab world, prostitution was legal and there were government-controlled red light districts. Abortion was available on demand. Alcohol was freely sold in restaurants. And the veil was banned in government institutions and discouraged elsewhere. It was very pro-women's rights. And in downtown Tunis, for example, there were cinemas that were basically gay cruising areas or meeting points. And everyone knew about this, apparently, and nobody did anything. It was just seen as people doing whatever they do according to their personal preferences. And because it wasn't political, like everything else in Tunisia, as long as something wasn't politicized, then people were allowed to get on with their lives quite freely.
It sounds quite unusual for that part of the world. What about the economy?
The economy was actually, until 2008, with the economic crash, in much better shape than certainly most of Europe is at the moment, and much of the rest of the world. 80% of Tunisians, according to the World Bank, belong to the middle class. And
that's amazing.
That is quite extraordinary. And economic growth was very strong. The problem is that historically, that essentially, the country had adopted what we might call a Singaporean model of governance, which is to say, in the turmoil of post-independence, what we'll do is restrict your political freedoms and the freedoms we grant you for expressing those your grievances on the street, but in turn, we'll improve your standard of living quite dramatically. And that worked until 2008, more or less, when the economic crisis came. And when that came, tourism dropped quite dramatically in Tunisia. And at the same time, foreign investment dropped. And because they'd invested so much in education over the past decades, I mean, Tunisia was the only country, in fact, that spent more on education than its defense budget in the Arab world. There were then tens of thousands of graduates graduating from a very good education system, and the regime wasn't providing jobs for them. And at the same time, stories of corruption among the elite started to emerge. And so that historic Singaporean pact, if you like, broke down. But over the past year, and during, especially when I was researching the latest book, I asked countless Tunisians that if the regime had provided jobs for graduates and had still restricted personal and political freedoms, would there have been a revolution? And absolutely everyone told me no way. The causes of this revolution in Tunisia in particular and elsewhere in the region were very much economic. It wasn't because of a great thirst for Western-style democracy.
I mean, that's a very interesting point, because we were constantly told that it was all about freedom and democracy. Why do you think we were told that, or why did we in the West get that impression?
Because those who were covering these revolutions, for the most part, don't speak Arabic. Also, there's a tendency of Western news organizations not to like dubbing and using subtitles, especially in short reports. And so people home in, especially on an English-speaking elite. And, of course, they speak a language literally that we understand, but also in terms that we understand. And so in America especially, the big news organizations are very aware that they well, they don't want to alienate their audiences with especially complicated ideas, and so much better to get a short clip of someone speaking English saying, we want freedom, we want democracy, because that is something that resonates with audiences. And the story is actually far more complicated than that.
Yeah. John, I remember reading, and maybe this is part of the myth you were just describing, that the revolt in Tunisia was sparked because a policewoman slapped a vegetable seller who then took his own life. Did that actually happen?
No, that didn't in fact happen. And even in post-revolutionary Tunisia, where the courts were to some extent freed of political influence, that policewoman was tried. Very thorough and lengthy trial, and in the end she was found not guilty. And in fact, that kind of thing didn't happen in Tunisia. It wasn't like Egypt, for example, where random violence and torture became endemic. In Tunisia, the police were actually, as long as you weren't an Islamist or a communist, say, and you were trying to organize a political demonstration in the street, the police were actually quite decent, with exceptions as elsewhere in the world. But no, that kind of stupid, random, arbitrary violence in the street didn't happen in Tunisia.
Okay. Now, an important point you make in the book is that revolutions should be judged by their results, not by their promises. What have been the results of that revolution in Tunisia? What's the political situation like now?
Well, we have to remember that Tunisia was the most secular country in the history of the Muslim world. Before this so-called revolution, the Islamists were not given an inch. And as I mentioned before, the regime was very social as well as political outlook. And what's happened is that the regime has fallen and the Islamists have filled the vacuum. It's not because they have majority support, and this is a point that we can generalize about the region with. It's the problem in the Middle East for the secularists and liberals is not that the Islamists have majority support among the population. The main problem is political apathy, which goes back to the point that I was making earlier about this really wasn't about a thirst for Western-style democracy and pluralism, because the turnout has been remarkably low in the election subsequently, which proves my point. So in Tunisia, for example, only 40% turned out. And so, yes, the Islamists won a plurality, but if you look at the data and you look at the Tunisians who voted and the number of those who voted for the Islamists and so on, it turns out that the Islamists took power despite the fact that 80% of Tunisians didn't actually vote for them. Mm. And that's the same in Egypt.
Right. And John, you earlier described what life was like in Tunisia in the past for us. What's life like now?
Oh, it's utterly miserable. I mean, it's a country that I was always excited to go to. And one reason was because it was so safe. And now crime rates are so high that I'm not sure right now because I haven't been there for a month or two. But certainly up until a year after the revolution, crime rates were still extraordinarily high. People weren't going out after dark, basically. The economy has tanked. Tourism, which was a mainstay of the economy, is down by about between a third and a half. And there are whole cities in Tunisia that depend on tourism, like Sousse, for example. And even in Sousse, the Islamists have been holding demonstrations saying they want tourism to be eradicated from the city, while offering, of course, no alternative at all.
What about the liberal intellectuals who supported the revolt so strongly? What's life like for them now?
Well, worse, because, for example, before the revolution, as long as you didn't promote an Islamist agenda or didn't criticize the regime directly, you could pretty much say whatever you wanted to say as a filmmaker in Tunisia. And now, not only are there still restrictions on what you can say about the new interim regime, which is just a watered-down version of the old regime, but now you have an Islamist-inspired censorship. And so, for example, cinemas have been bombed because they happened to be showing a film that promoted secularism. A filmmaker's home was firebombed too because his station broadcast a film that the Islamists deemed blasphemous. And an artist has been stabbed in the head in downtown Tunisia because he perceived as coming from a secular liberal perspective. And so that's the irony of the revolution, basically, that it has created superficially more democracy and greater freedom of expression. in a general way, but the problem is that because the Islamists have filled the vacuum, the idea of freedom of expression is then defined according to Islamist principles. And that means basically that you insult Islam.
Yeah. John, that's a very depressing story. Let's turn to another one, Egypt. You've already explained to us that Egypt was, of course, a very different sort of country. But after the dictator Hosni Mubarak was overthrown there in early 2011, did it follow the same sort of path, the revolution, as occurred in Tunisia?
Yeah, very much so. In the sense that, for example, the Islamists there had to get, during the elections, not a majority support from the total Egyptian population, but a majority within the minority who would vote. So, for example, again, although we were told that Egyptians were just desperate to partake in elections, what happened is that a month or so after Hosni Mubarak was overthrown in the first election, only 41% bothered to go and vote for a new constitution. 41% actually isn't even 41% of the total population. That's 41% of registered voters, which probably means that only between about 20 and 25% of Egyptians voted. Egypt is very similar to Tunisia in the sense that it's heavily dependent on tourism, and tourism there too has tanked and it shows no signs of recovery as of now. And foreign investment is way down to, in fact, to zero, more or less. And crime rates there too have skyrocketed. And of course, because Egypt is a far more populous country, it's actually the most populous country in the Arab world. It's about 80 million or so Egyptians as opposed to 10 million Tunisians. And because the police force was ineffective even before the revolution and then withdrew from the streets after it, Egypt is actually a very, very dangerous place now, in places like Agadagal and Sharm el-Sheikh, where they're quite small tourist towns where the tourist police are still in control, but actually have a vested interest in combating crime themselves because they depend on tourism. But elsewhere, it's essentially a catastrophe. The country is just in a nightmarish situation.
Mm. John, I know that you've predicted some of these events in your earlier books, which is quite an achievement. And also you've drawn a comparison with the Iranian Revolution of 1979. So I suppose from your point of view, these outcomes were foreseeable.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't necessarily predict what happened region-wide, but certainly back in 2008, I published a book on Egypt that had the subtitle, The Land of the Pharaohs on the Brink of a Revolution. Mm. And in the afterword to that book, I argued that if a revolution did in fact happen in Egypt, it would follow the pattern of the Iranian Revolution in 1979, as would others throughout the region. And of course, we always are told that the 1979 Iranian Revolution was an Islamist revolution. But in its initial stages, just as with the Egyptian and Tunisian revolutions, it was anything but. It drew people, as they say, from all walks of life. But what happened after the Shah fled was that because the Islamists were the most disciplined and the best organized with the longest history and the most charismatic leader, they were then subsequently able to fill the post-revolutionary vacuum and impose order on the chaos. And they did this and subsequently marginalized the foolish liberals and leftists and secularists and so on who had initially aligned themselves with the Islamists. And we've seen, as I suggested would happen in that 2008 book, the same thing happened in Egypt, in the sense that the liberals and progressive forces trusted the Islamists in the form of the Muslim Brotherhood initially. And the Muslim Brotherhood said, well, we stand for just half of the seats in the first round of parliamentary elections. And then they stood for all of them. They said, we're not going to present a presidential candidate. And this week, they've just announced that they are, in fact, presenting a presidential candidate. And they're backtracking on absolutely everything. And they're hell-bent on creating an Islamic state in Egypt. And so, yes, we've seen an action replay, effectively, of 1979.
Another sad situation. We've had some segments on the program about the situation of the Copts in Egypt. We don't have time to talk about the uprisings in other countries in any detail, but as a general summary, John, is it fair to say that the Arab Spring is over? And if that's the case, are things now probably worse than before all this began?
They're certainly worse in the short term in terms of social stability and economic progress. also in terms of freedom of expression. We've already talked about Tunisia, but in Egypt, one of the ironies was that in the 5 or 6 years before the revolution, there was complete freedom of expression in the media. There were opposition newspapers where you could say anything against Hosni Mubarak and his sons on the front page, for example, so long as it wasn't libelous. And now, in the Egyptian media, you can't criticize the ruling military council. So even in that country, which was in fact very repressive, there's been a step backward in terms of freedom of expression. And so region-wide, basically my argument is that Saudi Arabia is the most repressive and oppressive country in the region. And unless there had been some kind of radical uprising in Saudi Arabia, there was never a chance of this so-called Arab Spring succeeding elsewhere, because Saudi Arabia is very closely aligned to the West, and also it's installing its Islamist proxies from Tunisia to Egypt, from Yemen to soon in Syria. And so nothing did in fact happen in Saudi Arabia. The West stuck with Saudi Arabia despite its pro-democracy rhetoric. And so essentially things are back to square one, but without the security and without the relative economic well-being before. And so it is in fact a very depressing story, although no one, very few people want to hear the fact.
Yeah. Are there any lessons you think that we can take from the Arab Spring for our own region in Southeast Asia?
Essentially that in Southeast Asia, sure, because what's happened here, I'm actually talking to you from Bangkok because I'm researching a piece on the uprising in the south of Thailand, where there are three Muslim majority states. And the problem with an Islamist takeover effectively is that although the Islamists are brought to power through the ballot box, which has happened in Malaysia, for example, and Indonesia, meaning that in the long term they can be voted out, what they do is radicalize their societies from below. They don't need to impose Sharia law. They don't need to institutionalize their Islamist agenda. What they do is they use the political power that they gain in order to radicalize from below. And even if, as happened in Indonesia, for example, in 2009, the Islamists are subsequently voted out of office, their legacy is such that it becomes almost like trying to criticize radical Islam or the more absurd manifestations of Islamist rule in Indonesia, despite the fact that the Islamists are no longer technically in power, becomes almost as impossible as, for example, an American senator trying to stand up to argue that the age of consent should be abolished for, and there shouldn't be one in a full U.S. Senate. I mean, it just becomes impossible to the point of absurdity. And so that's the legacy for the Middle East, I think. That's the real danger, that, yes, maybe in 5, 10, 15 years, the Islamists could be voted out of office, but by that time, they'll have imposed Islamist and intimidation to such an extent throughout so much of the region that it would be practically impossible in the short to medium term to reverse that trend.
Yeah. Well, John, thanks very much for talking with us. Your book's it's depressing, but it's also extremely powerful and fascinating. It certainly gives us an alternative of what you've called the happy clappy Arab Spring narrative. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Our guest has been John R. Bradley. We've been talking about his book, After the Arab Spring, How Islamists Hijacked the Middle East Revolts, and that's by Palgrave Macmillan.